a banished man living off his wits in a foreign land. He seemed disinclined to talk with me, and I was glad not to talk with him, yet now and then, during that long, heavy, talkative supper party, though all my attention was given to those complex and powerful Orgota who meant to befriend or use me, I was sharply aware of him, of his silence, of his dark, averted face. And it crossed my mind, though I dismissed the idea as baseless, that I had not come to Mishnori to eat roast blackfish with the commensals of my own free will. Nor had they brought me here. He had. Chapter 9. Estravan the Traitor. An East Karhidish tale, as told in Gorenhering by Tobor Chorhawa and recorded by G.A. The story is well known in various versions, and a Haban play based on it is in the repertory of traveling players east of the Kargav. Long ago, before the days of King Argavan I, who made Karhide one kingdom, there was a blood feud between the domain of Stok and the domain of Estra in Kermland. The feud had been fought in forays and ambushes for three generations, and there was no settling it, for it was a dispute over land. Rich land is scarce in Kerm, and a dominion's pride is in the length of its borders, and the lords of Kermland are proud men and umbrageous men, casting black shadows. It chanced that the heir of the flesh of the Lord of Estra, a young man, skiing across Icefoot Lake in the month of Irem, hunting Pesthri, came onto rotten ice and fell into the lake. Though by using one ski as a lever on a firmer ice edge, he pulled himself up out of the water at last, he was in almost as bad case out of the lake as in it, for he was drenched, the air was kurum, and night was coming on. Kurum, damp weather, 0 degrees to minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. He saw no hope of reaching Estra 8 miles away uphill, and so set off towards the village of Abos, on the north shore of the lake. As night fell, the fog flowed down off the glacier, and spread out all across the lake so that he could not see his way, nor where to set his skis. Slowly he went, for fear of rotten ice, yet in haste because the cold was at his bones, and before long he would not be able to move. He saw at last a light before him in the night and fog. He cast off his skis, for the lake shore was rough going and bare of snow in places. His legs would not well hold him up any more, and he struggled as best he could to the light. He was far astray from the way to Abos. This was a small house, set by itself in a forest of the Thor trees, that are all the woods of Kermland, and they grew close all about the house, and no taller than its roof. He beat at the door with his hands, and called aloud, and one opened the door and brought him into firelight. There was no else there, only this one person alone. He took Estravan's clothes off him that were like clothes of iron with the ice, and put him naked between furs, and with the warmth of his own body drove out the frost from Estravan's feet and hands and face, and gave him hot ale to drink. At last the young man was recovered, and looked on the one who cared for him. This was a stranger, young as himself. They looked at each other. Each of them was comely, strong of frame and fine of feature, straight and dark. Estravan saw that the fire of Kemmer was in the face of the other. He said, "I am Arek of Estra." The other said, "I am Therem of Stok." Then Estravan laughed, for he was still weak, and said, "Did you warm me back to life in order to kill me, Stokven?" The other said, "No." He put out his hand and touched Estravan's hand, as if he were making certain that the frost was driven out. At the touch, though Estravan was a day or two from his kemmer, he felt the fire waken in himself. So for a while, both held still, their hands touching. "They are the same," said Stokven, and laying his palm against Estravan's, showed it was so. Their hands were the same in length and form, finger by finger, matching like the two hands of one man laid palm to palm. "I have never seen you before," Stokven said. "We are mortal enemies." He rose and built up the fire in the hearth, and returned to sit by Estravan. "We are mortal enemies," said Estravan. "I would swear Kemmering with you."
"And I with you," said the other.
Then they vowed Kemmering to each other. And in Kermland, then as now, that vow of faithfulness is not to be broken, not to be replaced. That night, and the day that followed, and the night that followed, they spent in the hut, in the forest by the frozen lake. On the next morning, a party of men from Stok came to the hut. One of them knew young Estravan by sight. He said no word and gave no warning, but drew his knife, and there, in Stokven's sight, stabbed Estravan in the throat and chest, and the young man fell across the cold hearth in his blood, dead. "He was the heir of Estra," the murderer said. Stokven said, "Put him on your sledge, and take him to Estra for burial." He went back to Stok. The men set off with Estravan's body on the sledge, but they left it far in the Thor forest for wild beasts to eat, and returned that night to Stok. Therem stood up before his parent in the flesh, Lord Harish Rem Ir Stokven, and said to the men, "Did you do as I bid you?" They answered, "Yes," Therem said. "You lie, for you would never have come back alive from Estra. These men have disobeyed my command, and lied to hide their disobedience. I ask their banishment." Lord Harish granted it, and they were driven out of hearth and law. Soon after this, Therem left his domain, saying that he wished to indwell at Rother of Fastness for a time, and he did not return to Stok until a year had passed. Now, in the domain of Estra, they sought for Arrak in mountain and plain, and then mourned for him. Bitter the mourning through summer and autumn, for he had been the Lord's one child of the flesh. But in the end of the month Thurn, when winter lay heavy on the land, a man came up the mountainside on skis, and gave to the warder at Estra Gate a bundle wrapped in furs, saying, "This is Therem, the sun's son of Estra." Then he was down the mountain on his skis like a rock, skipping over water, gone before any thought to hold him. In the bundle of furs lay a newborn child, weeping. They brought the child in to Lord Sorver, and told him the stranger's words, and the old lord, full of grief, saw in the baby his lost son, Arrak. He ordered that the child be reared as a son of the inner hearth, and that he be called Therem, though that was not a name ever used by the clan of Estra. The child grew comely, fine and strong. He was dark of nature and silent, yet all saw in him some likeness to the lost Arrak. When he was grown, Lord Sorve, in the wilfulness of old age, named him heir of Estra. Then there were swollen hearts among Sorve's Kemmering sons, all strong men in their prime, who had waited long for lordship. They laid ambush against young Therem when he went out alone hunting Pestri in the month of Irem. But he was armed and not taken unawares. Two of his hearth brothers he shot, in the fog that lay thick on Icefoot Lake, in the thaw weather, and a third he fought with, knife to knife, and killed at last, though he himself was wounded on the chest and neck with deep cuts. Then he stood above his brother's body in the mist over the ice, and saw that night was falling. He grew sick and weak as the blood ran from his wounds, and he thought to go to Abos village for help. But in the gathering dark he went astray, and came to the Thor forest on the east shore of the lake. There, seeing an abandoned hut, he entered it, and too faint to light a fire, he fell down on the cold stones of the hearth and lay so with his wounds unstanched. One came in out of the night, a man alone. He stopped in the doorway and was still, staring at the man who lay in his blood across the hearth. Then he entered in haste and made a bed of furs that he took out of an old chest and built up a fire and cleaned Therem's wounds and bound them. When he saw the young man look at him, he said, "I am Therem of Stok. I am Therem of Estra." There was silence a while between them. Then the young man smiled and said, "Did you bind up my wounds in order to kill me, Stokven?" "No," said the older one. Estravan asked, "How does it chance that you, the Lord of Stok, are here on disputed land alone?" "I come here often," Stokven replied. He felt the young man's pulse and hand for fever, and for an instant laid his palm flat to Estravan's palm, and finger by finger their two hands matched, like the two hands of one man. "We are mortal enemies," said Stockfin. Estrefan answered, "We are mortal enemies. Yet I have never seen you before." Stockfin turned aside his face. "Once I saw you, long ago," he said. "I wish there might be peace between our houses." Estrefan said, "I will vow peace with you." So they made that vow, and then spoke no more, and the hurt man slept. In the morning, Stockfin was gone, but a party of people from Abos village came to the hut and carried Estrefan home to Estra. There none dared longer oppose the old lord's will, the rightness of which was written plain in three men's blood on the lake ice. And at Sorva's death, Theram became lord of Estra. Within the year he ended the old feud, giving up half the disputed lands to the domain of Stock. For this, and for the murder of his hearth brothers, he was called Estrefan the Traitor. Yet his name, Theram, is still given to children of that domain. Chapter 10 Conversations in Mishnori. Next morning, as I finished a late breakfast served to me in my suite in Shuskis's mansion, the house phone emitted a polite bleat. When I switched it on, the caller spoke in Karhadish.
"Theram Harth here. May I come up?"
"Please do." I was glad to get the confrontation over with at once. It was plain that no tolerable relationship could exist between Estrefan and myself. Even though his disgrace and exile were at least nominally on my account, I could take no responsibility for them, feel no rational guilt. He had made neither his acts nor his motives clear to me in Erenrang, and I could not trust the fellow. I wished that he was not mixed up with these Orgota who had, as it were, adopted me. His presence was a complication and an embarrassment. He was shown into the room by one of the many house employees. I had him sit down in one of the large padded chairs and offered him breakfast ale. He refused. His manner was not constrained. He had left shyness a long way behind him, if he ever had any. But it was restrained, tentative, aloof.
"The first real snow," he said, and seeing my glance at the heavily curtained window, "you haven't looked out yet?"
I did so, and saw snow whirling thick on a light wind down the street, over the whitened roofs. 2 or 3 inches had fallen in the night. It was Odarhad Gor, the 17th of the first month of autumn. "It's early," I said, caught by the snow spell for a moment.
"They predict a hard winter this year."
I left the curtains drawn back. The bleak, even light from outside fell on his dark face. He looked older. He had known some hard times since I saw him last, in the corner red dwelling of the palace in Erenrang, by his own fireside. "I have here what I was asked to bring you," I said, and gave him the foilskin-wrapped packet of money, which I had set out on a table ready after his call. He took it and thanked me gravely. I had not sat down. After a moment, still holding the packet, he stood up. My conscience itched a little, but I did not scratch it. I wanted to discourage him from coming to me. That this involved humiliating him was unfortunate. He looked straight at me. He was shorter than I, of course, short-legged and compact, not as tall even as many women of my race. Yet when he looked at me, he did not seem to be looking up at me. I did not meet his eyes. I examined the radio on the table with a show of abstracted interest.
"One can't believe everything one hears on that radio here," he said pleasantly. "Yet it seems to me that here in Mishnori you are going to be in some need of information and advice."
"There seem to be a number of people quite ready to supply it."
"And there's safety in numbers, eh? 10 are more trustworthy than one. Excuse me, I shouldn't use Karhaitish, I forgot. he went on in Orgota. Banished men should never speak their native tongue. It comes bitter from their mouths. And this language suits a traitor better, I think. Drips off one's teeth like sugar syrup. Mr. I have the right to thank you. You performed a service both for me and for my old friend and Kemmering, Asha Forif. And in his name and mine, I claim my right. My thanks take the form of advice. He paused. I said nothing. I had never heard him use this sort of harsh, elaborate courtesy, and had no idea what it signified. He went on. You are, in Mishnori, what you were not in Erenrang. There they say you were. Here they'll say you're not. You are the tool of a faction. I advise you to be careful how you let them use you. I advise you to find out what the enemy faction is and who they are, and never to let them use you, for they will not use you well. He stopped. I was about to demand that he be more specific, but he said, "Goodbye, Mr. I," turned, and left. I stood benumbed. The man was like an electric shock. Nothing to hold on to, and you don't know what hit you. He had certainly spoiled the mood of peaceful self-congratulation in which I had eaten breakfast. I went to the narrow window and looked out. The snow had thinned a little. It was beautiful, drifting in white clots and clusters, like a fall of cherry petals in the orchards of my home. When a spring wind blows down the green slopes of Borland, where I was born. On earth, warm earth, where trees bear flowers in spring. All at once I was utterly downcast and homesick. 2 years I had spent on this damned planet. And the third winter had begun before autumn was underway. Months and months of unrelenting cold, sleet, ice, wind, rain, snow. Cold, cold inside, cold outside, cold to the bone and the marrow of the bone. And all that time on my own, alien and isolate, without a soul I could trust. Poor Genli, shall we cry? I saw Estravan come out of the house onto the street below me, a dark, foreshortened figure in the even, vague gray-white of the snow. He looked about, adjusting the loose belt of his hieb. He wore no coat. He set off down the street, walking with a deft, definite grace, a quickness of being that made him seem, in that minute, the only thing alive in all Mishnori. I turned back to the warm room. Its comforts were stuffy and cloddish. The heater, the padded chairs, the bed piled with furs, the rugs, drapes, wrappings, mufflings. I put on my winter coat and went out for a walk. In a disagreeable mood. In a disagreeable world. I was to lunch that day with Commensals Opsler and Yege and others I had met the night before, and to be introduced to some I had not met. Lunch is usually served from a buffet and eaten standing up, perhaps so that one will not feel he has spent the entire day sitting at table. For this formal affair, however, places were set at table, and the buffet was enormous. 18 or 20 hot and cold dishes, mostly variations on sube eggs and bread apple. At the sideboard, before the taboo on conversation applied, Opsley remarked to me while loading up his plate with batter-fried sube eggs, "The fellow named Mersen is a spy from Erenrang, and Gaum there is an open agent of the Sarf, you know." He spoke conversationally, laughed as if I had made an amusing reply, and moved off to the pickled blackfish. I had no idea what the Sarf was. As people were beginning to sit down, a young fellow came in and spoke to the host, Yege, who then turned to us. "News from Karhide," he said. "King Argaven's child was born this morning and died within the hour." There was a pause, and a buzz, And then the handsome man called Gaum laughed, and lifted up his beer tankard. "May all the kings of Karide live as long," he cried. Some drank the toast with him. Most did not.
"Aim of measure to laugh at a child's death," said a fat old man in purple, sitting heavily down beside me,
his leggings bunched around his thighs like skirts, his face heavy with disgust. Discussion arose as to which of his Kemmering sons Argivan might name as his heir. For he was well over 40, and would now surely have no child of his flesh, and how long he might leave Tyve as regent. Some thought the regency would be ended at once, others were dubious.
"What do you think, Mr. I?"
asked the man called Merson, whom Opsa had identified as a Karhaitish agent, and thus presumably one of Tyve's own men.
"You've just come from Erenrang. What are they saying there about these rumors that Argivan has, in fact, abdicated without announcement, handed the sledge over to his cousin?"
"Well, I've heard the rumor, yes."
"Do you think it's got any foundation?"
"I have no idea," I said. And at this point the host intervened with a mention of the weather, for people had begun to eat. After servants had cleared away the plates and the mountainous wreckage of roasts and pickles from the buffet, we all sat on around the long table. Small cups of a fierce liquor were served. Life water, they called it, as men often do, and they asked me questions. Since my examination by the physicians and scientists of Erenrang, I had not been faced with a group of people who wanted me to answer their questions. Few Karhiders, even the fishermen and farmers with whom I had spent my first months, had been willing to satisfy their curiosity, which is often intense, by simply asking. They were involute, introvert, indirect. They did not like questions and answers. I thought of all their horrid fastness, of what Faxa the Weaver had said concerning answers. Even the experts had limited their questions to strictly physiological subjects, such as the glandular and circulatory functions in which I differed most notably from the Gathenian norm. They had never gone on to ask, for example, how the continuous sexuality of my race influenced its social institutions, how we handled our permanent Kemmer. They listened when I told them. The psychologists listened when I told them about mind-speech, but not one of them had brought himself to ask enough general questions to form any adequate picture of Terran or ecumenical society, except, perhaps, Estrovan. Here they weren't quite so tied up by considerations of everybody's prestige and pride, and questions evidently were not insulting either to the asker or the one questioned. However, I soon saw that some of the questioners were out to catch me, to prove me a fraud. That threw me off balance a minute. I had, of course, met with incredulity in Karhide, but seldom with a will to incredulity. Tybe had put on an elaborate show of going along with the hoax the day of the parade in Erenrang, but as I now knew, that was part of the game he had played to discredit Estrovan, and I guessed that Tybe did in fact believe me. He had seen my ship, after all, the little lander that had brought me down on planet. He had free access, along with anyone else, to the engineer's reports on the ship and the Ansible. None of these Orgota had seen the ship. I could show them the Ansible, but it didn't make a very convincing alien artifact, being so incomprehensible as to fit in with hoax, as well as with reality. The old law of cultural embargo stood against the importation of analyzable, imitable artifacts at this stage, and so I had nothing with me except the ship and Ansible, my box of pictures, the indubitable peculiarity of my body, and the unprovable singularity of my mind. The pictures passed around the table, and were examined with the non-committal expression you see on the faces of people looking at pictures of somebody else's family. The questioning continued. "What," asked Opsler, "was the Ecumen? A world? A league of worlds? A place? A government?"
"Well, all of those and none.
Ecumen is our Terran word. In the common tongue it's called the household. In Karhaidish it'd be the hearth. In Orgota, I'm not sure. I don't know the language well enough yet. Not the commensality, I think, though there are undoubtedly similarities between the commensal government and the ecumen, but the ecumen is not essentially a government at all. It is an attempt to reunify the mystical with the political, and as such is, of course, mostly a failure. But its failure has done more good for humanity so far than the successes of its predecessors. It is a society, and it has at least potentially a culture. It is a form of education. In one aspect, it's a sort of very large school. Very large indeed. The motives of communication and cooperation are of its essence. And therefore, in another aspect, it's a league or union of worlds possessing some degree of centralized conventional organization. It's this aspect, the league, that I now represent. The ecumen, as a political entity, functions through coordination, not by rule. It does not enforce laws. Decisions are reached by counsel and consent, not by consensus or command. As an economic entity, it is immensely active, looking after inter-world communication, keeping the balance of trade among the 80 worlds, 84 to be precise, if Gethen enters the ecumen.
What do you mean, it doesn't enforce its laws?
Said Slosser. It hasn't any. Member states follow their own laws. When they clash, the ecumen mediates, attempts to make a legal or ethical adjustment or collation or choice. Now, if the ecumen, as an experiment in the superorganic, does eventually fail, it will have to become a peacekeeping force, develop a police, and so on. But at this point, there's no need. All the central worlds are still recovering from a disastrous era a couple of centuries ago, reviving lost skills and lost ideas, learning how to talk again. How could I explain the age of the enemy and its after effects to a people who had no word for war?
This is absolutely fascinating, Mr. I, said the host,
Commensal Yege, a delicate, dapper, drawling fellow with keen eyes.
But I can't see what they'd want with us. I mean to say, what particular good is an 84th world to them, and not, I take it, a very clever world, for we don't have starships and so on, as they all do.
None of us did, until the Hainish and the Cetians arrived. And some worlds still weren't allowed to, for centuries, until the ecumen established the canons for what I think you here call open trade. That got a laugh all around, for it was the name of Yage's party, or faction, within the commensality. Open trade is really what I'm here to try to set up. Trade not only in goods, of course, but in knowledge, technologies, ideas, philosophies, art, medicine, science, theory. I doubt that Gethen would ever do much physical coming and going to the other worlds. We are 17 light-years here from the nearest ecumenical world, Olol, a planet of the star you call Asyomse. The farthest is 250 light-years away, and you cannot even see its star. With the Ansible communicator, you could talk with that world as if by radio with the next town. But I doubt you'd ever meet any people from it. The kind of trade I speak of can be highly profitable, but it consists largely of simple communication rather than of transportation. My job here is really to find out if you're willing to communicate with the rest of mankind.
You, Slosser repeated, leaning forward intensely. Does that mean Ogorain? Or does it mean Gethen as a whole?
I hesitated a moment, for it was not the question I had expected. Here and now it means Ogorain. But the contract cannot be exclusive. If Sif or the island nations or Karhai decide to enter the ecumen, they may. It's a matter of individual choice each time. Then what generally happens on a planet as highly developed as Gethen is that the various anthrotypes or regions or nations end up by establishing a set of representatives to function as coordinator on the planet, and with the other planets. A local stability, in our terms. A lot of time is saved by beginning this way, and money by sharing the expense. If you decided to set up a starship of your own, for instance.
By the milk of Meshe, said Fat Humery beside me, you want us to go shooting off into the void? Ugh!
He wheezed like the high notes of an accordion in disgust and amusement. Gaum spoke.
Where is your ship, Mr. I?
He put the question softly, half smiling as if it were extremely subtle, and he wished the subtlety to be noticed. He was a most extraordinarily handsome human being, by any standards, and as either sex, and I couldn't help staring at him as I answered and also wondered again what the Sarf was. Why, that's no secret. It was talked about a good bit on the Carhartish radio. The rocket that landed me on Horden Island is now in the Royal Workshop Foundry in the Artisan School. Most of it, anyway. I think various experts went off with various bits of it after they had examined it.
Rocket?
Inquired Humery, for I had used the Orgota word for firecracker. It succinctly describes the method of propulsion of the landing boat, sir. Humery wheezed some more. Gaum merely smiled, saying, "Then you have no means of returning to, well, wherever you came from." "Oh, yes. I could speak to Olul by Ansible, and ask them to send an NAFAL ship to pick me up. It would get here in 17 years. Or I could radio to the starship that brought me into your solar system. It's in orbit around your sun now. It would get here in a matter of days." The sensation that caused was visible and audible, and even Gaum couldn't hide his surprise. There was some discrepancy here. This was the one major fact I had kept concealed in Carhide, even from Esraven. If, as I had been given to understand, the Orgota knew about me only what Carhide had chosen to tell them, then this should have been only one among many surprises, but it wasn't. It was the big one.
"Where is this ship, sir?"
Yege demanded. "Orbiting the sun, somewhere between Gethen and Kuhurn."
"How did you get from it to here?"
"By the firecracker," said old Humery.
"Precisely. We don't land an interstellar ship on a populated planet until open communication or alliance is established. So I came in on a little rocket boat and landed on Horden Island."
"And you can get in touch with the big ship by ordinary radio, Mr. I?"
That was Obsler.
"Yes.
I omitted mention for the present of my little relay satellite, set into orbit from the rocket. I did not want to give them the impression that their sky was full of my junk.
It would take a fairly powerful transmitter, but you have plenty of those." "Then we could radio your ship?"
"Yes, if you had the proper signal. The people aboard are in a condition we call stasis. Hibernation, you might say, so that they won't lose out of their lives the years they spend waiting for me to get my business done down here. The proper signal and the proper wavelength will set machinery in motion that will bring them out of stasis, after which they'll consult with me by radio or by Ansible using Olul as relay center." Someone asked uneasily,
"How many of them?"
11. That brought a little sound of relief, a laugh. The tension relaxed a little.
"What if you never signaled?" Obsler asked.
"They'll come out of stasis automatically about 4 years from now."
"Would they come here after you, then?"
"Not unless they'd heard from me. They'd consult with the Stabules on Olul and Hain by Ansible. Most likely they've decided to try again, send down another person as envoy. The second envoy often finds things easier than the first. He has less explaining to do, and people are likelier to believe him." Obstler grinned. Most of the others still looked thoughtful and guarded. Gaum gave me an airy little nod as if applauding my quickness to reply. A conspirator's nod. Slosser was staring bright-eyed and tense at some inner vision, from which he turned abruptly to me.
"Why," he said,
Mr. Anvar, did you never speak of this other ship during your 2 years in Karhide?
How do we know that he didn't? Said Gaum, smiling.
We know damned well that he didn't, Mr. Gaum, said Yergay, also smiling.
I didn't, I said. This is why. The idea of that ship waiting out there can be an alarming one. I think some of you find it so. In Karhide, I never advanced to a point of confidence with those I dealt with that allowed me to take the risk of speaking of the ship. Here, you've had longer to think about me. You're willing to listen to me out in the open, in public. You're not so much ruled by fear. I took the risk because I think the time has come to take it, and that Orgorain is the place.
You are right, Mr. I. You are right, Slosser said violently. Within a month, you will send for that ship, and it will be made welcome in Orgorain as the visible sign and seal of the new epoch. Their eyes will be opened who will not see now.
It went on, right on till dinner was served to us where we sat. We ate and drank and went home. I, for one, worn out, but pleased all in all with the way things had gone. There were warnings and obscurities, of course. Slosser wanted to make a religion of me. Gaum wanted to make a sham of me. Merson seemed to want to prove that he was not a Karhidish agent by proving that I was. But Obsla, Yegay, and some others were working on a higher level. They wanted to communicate with the Stabials and to bring the NAFAL ship down on our Gota ground in order to persuade or coerce the commensality of Orgorain to ally itself with the Ecumen. They believed that in doing so, Orgorain would gain a large and lasting prestige victory over Karhide, and that the commensals who engineered this victory would gain according prestige and power in their government. Their open trade faction, a minority in the 33, opposed the continuation of the Sinoth Valley dispute, and in general represented a conservative, an aggressive, non-nationalistic policy. They had been out of power for a long time, and were calculating that their way back to power might, with some risks taken, lie on the road I pointed out. That they saw no farther than that, that my mission was a means to them and not an end, was no great harm. Once they were on the road, they might begin to get some sense of where it could take them. Meanwhile, if short-sighted, they were at least realistic. Obsla, speaking to persuade others, had said,
"Either Karhide will fear the strength this alliance will give us, and Karhide is always afraid of new ways and new ideas, remember, and so will hang back and be left behind, or else the Erenran government will get up their courage and come and ask to join after us in second place. In either case, the Shif Grethar of Karhide will be diminished, and in either case we drive the sledge. If we have the wits to take this advantage now, it will be a permanent advantage and a certain one." Then turning to me, "But the Ecumen must be willing to help us, Mr. I. We have got to have more to show our people than you alone, one man already known in Erenral."
"I see that, Commensal. You'd like a good showy proof, and I'd like to offer one, but I cannot bring down the ship until its safety and your integrity are reasonably secure. I need the consent and the guarantee of your government, which I take it would mean the whole board of commensals, publicly announced."
Opsa looked dour, but said, "Fair enough."
Driving home with Shuskis, who had contributed nothing but his jovial laugh to the afternoon's business, I asked, "Mr. Shuskis, what is the SARF?"
"One of the permanent bureaus of the Internal Administration. Looks out after false registries, unauthorized travel, job substitutions, forgeries, that sort of thing. Trash. That's what SARF means in gutter or gota, trash. It's a nickname."
"Then the inspectors are agents of the SARF?"
"Well, some are."
"And the police, I suppose they come under its authority to some extent?" I put the question cautiously, and was answered in kind.
"I suppose so. I'm in the external administration, of course, and I can't keep all the officers straight over in internal."
"They certainly are confusing.
Now what's the Waters office, for instance? So I backed off as best I could from the subject of the Sarf. What Chuskis had not said on the subject might have meant nothing at all to a man from Hain, say, or lucky Chifawar, but I was born on Earth. It is not altogether a bad thing to have criminal ancestors. An arsonist's grandfather may bequeath one a nose for smelling smoke. It had been entertaining and fascinating to find, here on Gethin, governments so similar to those in the ancient histories of Terra. A monarchy, and a genuine full-blown bureaucracy. This new development was also fascinating, but less entertaining. It was odd that, in the less primitive society, the more sinister note was struck. So Gaum, who wanted me to be a liar, was an agent of the secret police of Orgorain. Did he know that Opsley knew him as such? No doubt he did. Was he then the agent provocateur? Was he nominally working with or against Opsley's faction? Which of the factions within the government of 33 controlled or was controlled by the Sarf? I had better get these matters straight, but it might not be easy to do so. My course, which for a while had looked so clear and hopeful, seemed likely to become as tortuous and beset with secrets as it had been in Erenrang. Everything had gone all right, I thought, until Estraven had appeared shadow-like at my side last night. "What's Lord Estraven's position here in Mishnori?" I asked Shuskis, who had settled back as if half asleep in the corner of the smooth-running car.
"Estraven? Harth, he's called here, you know. We don't have titles in Orgorain. Dropped all that with the new epoch. Well, he's a dependent of Commensal Yeagaze, I understand."
"He lives there?"
"I believe so."
I was about to say that it was odd that he had been at Slosis last night and not at Yeagaze today, when I saw that, in the light of our brief morning interview, it wasn't very odd. Yet even the idea that he was intentionally keeping away made me uncomfortable.
"They found him," said Shuskis, resettling his broad hips on the cushioned seat, "over in the south side, in a glue factory or a fish cannery or some such place, and gave him a hand out of the gutter. Some of the open trade crowd, I mean. Of course he was useful to them when he was in the Curamy and Prime Minister, so they stand by him now. Mainly they do it to annoy Merson, I think. Merson's a spy for the Tibe. And of course he thinks nobody knows it, but everybody does, and he can't stand the sight of Harth. Thinks he's either a traitor or a double agent, and doesn't know which, and can't risk Schiff Greffer in finding out.
"Which do you think Harth is, Mr. Shuskis?"
"A traitor, Mr. I, pure and simple. Sold out his country's claims in the Sinoth Valley in order to prevent Tibe's rise to power, but didn't manage it cleverly enough. He'd have met with worse punishment than exile here. By Mesh's tits, if you play against your own side, you'll lose the whole game. That's what these fellows with no patriotism, only self-love, can't see. Though I don't suppose Harth much cares where he is, so long as he can keep on wriggling towards some kind of power. He hasn't done so badly here in 5 months, as you see."
"Not so badly."
"You don't trust him either, eh?"
"No, I don't."
"I'm glad to hear it, Mr. I. I don't see why Yeagaze and Opsley hang on to the fellow. He's a proven traitor. Out for his own profit. And trying to hang on to your sledge, Mr. I, until he can keep himself going. That's how I see it. Well, I don't know that I'd give him any free rides, if he came asking me for one."
Shuskis puffed and nodded vigorously in approval of his own opinion, and smiled at me, the smile of one virtuous man to another. The car ran softly through the wide, well-lit streets. The morning snow was melted except for dingy heaps along the gutters. It was raining now, a cold, small rain. The great buildings of central Mishnori, government offices, schools, Yomesh temples, were so blurred by rain in the liquid glare of the high street lights that they looked as if they were melting. Their corners were vague, their facades streaked, dewed, smeared. There was something fluid, insubstantial, in the very heaviness of this city built of monoliths, this
monolithic state that called the part in the whole by the same name. And Shuskis, my jovial host, a heavy man, a substantial man, he too was somehow, around the corners and edges, a little vague, a little, just a little bit unreal. Ever since I had set off by car through the wide golden fields of Ogorain 4 days ago, beginning my successful progress towards the inner sanctums of Mishnori, I had been missing something, but what? I felt insulated. I had not felt the cold lately. They kept rooms decently warm here. I had not eaten with pleasure lately. Ogota cooking was insipid, no harm in that. But why did the people I met, whether well or ill-disposed towards me, also seem insipid? There were vivid personalities among them. Opsla, Slosa, the handsome and detestable Gaum. And yet each of them lacked some quality, some dimension of being. And they failed to convince. They were not quite solid. It was, I thought, as if they did not cast shadows. This kind of rather high-flown speculation is an essential part of my job. Without some capacity for it, I could not have qualified as a mobile, and I received formal training in it on Hain, where they dignify it with the title of far-fetching. What one is after when far-fetching might be described as the intuitive perception of a moral entirety, and thus it tends to find expression not in rational symbols, but in metaphor. I was never an outstanding far-fetcher, and this night I distrusted my own intuitions, being very tired. When I was back in my apartment, I took refuge in a hot shower. But even there, I felt a vague unease, as if the hot water was not altogether real and reliable, and could not be counted on. Chapter 11 Soliloquies in Mishnori. Mishnori, stresses me. I am not hopeful, yet all events show cause for hope. Opsla haggles and dickers with his fellow commensals. Yege employs blandishments, Slosa proselytizes, and the strength of their following grows. They are astute men, and have their faction well in hand. Only 7 of the 33 are reliable open traders. Of the rest, Opsla thinks to gain the sure support of 10, giving a bare majority. One of them seems to have a true interest in the envoy, Commensal Ithipen of the Anian district, who has been curious about the alien mission since, while working for the Sarf, he was in charge of censoring the broadcasts we sent out from Erenrang. He seems to carry the weight of those suppressions on his conscience. He proposed to Opsla that the 33 announce their invitation to the starship not only to their countrymen but at the same time to Karhide, asking Argaven to join Karhide's voice to the invitation. A noble plan, and it will not be followed. They will not ask Karhide to join them in anything. The Sarf's men among the 33, of course, oppose any consideration at all of the envoy's presence and mission. As for those lukewarm and uncommitted whom Opsla hopes to enlist, I think they fear the envoy, much as Argaven and most of the court did, with this difference that Argaven thought him mad like himself, while they think him a liar like themselves. They fear to swallow a great hoax in public, a hoax already refused by Karhide, a hoax perhaps even invented by Karhide. They make their invitation, they make it publicly, then where is their ship Grethor, when no starship comes? Indeed, Genli Ai demands of us an inordinate trustfulness. To him, evidently, it is not inordinate. And Opsla and Yege think that a majority of the 33 will be persuaded to trust him. I do not know why I am less hopeful than they. Perhaps I do not really want Ogorain to prove more enlightened than Karhide, to take the risk and win the praise and leave Karhide in the shadow. If this envy be patriotic, it comes too late. As soon as I saw that Tybe would soon have me ousted, I did all I could to ensure that the envoy would come to Ogorain,
and in exile here I have done what I could to win them to him.
Thanks to the money he brought me from Asha, I now live by myself again, as a unit, not a dependent. I go to no more banquets. I'm not seen in public with Opsla or other supporters of the envoy, and have not seen the envoy himself for over a half month, since his second day in Mishnori. He gave me Asha's money, as one would give a hired assassin his fee. I have not often been so angry, and I insulted him deliberately. He knew I was angry, but I am not sure he understood that he was insulted. He seemed to accept my advice, despite the manner of its giving, and when my temper cooled, I saw this and was worried by it. Is it possible that all along in Erin Rang he was seeking my advice, not knowing how to tell me that he sought it? If so, then he must have misunderstood half, and not understood the rest of what I told him by my fireside in the palace, the night after the ceremony of the keystone. His Sif Grethar must be founded and composed and sustained altogether differently from ours. And when I thought myself most blunt and frank with him, he may have found me most subtle and unclear. His obtuseness is ignorance. His arrogance is ignorance. He is ignorant of us, we of him. He is infinitely a stranger, and I a fool, to let my shadow cross the light of the hope he brings us. I keep my mortal vanity down. I keep out of his way. For clearly that is what he wants. He is right. An exiled Karhidish traitor is no credit to his cause. Conformable to the Orgoto law that each unit must have employment, I work from 8 hour to noon in a plastics factory. Easy work. I run a machine that fits together and heat bonds pieces of plastic to form little transparent boxes. I do not know what the boxes are for. In the afternoon, finding myself dull, I have taken up the old disciplines I learned in Rothera. I am glad to see I have lost no skill at summoning Dotha's strength or entering the untrance. But I get little good out of the untrance, and as for the skills of stillness and of fasting, I might as well never have learned them, and must start all over like a child. I have fasted now 1 day, and my belly screams, a week, a month. The nights freeze now. Tonight a hard wind bears frozen rain. All evening I have thought continually of Estra, and the sound of the wind seems the sound of the wind that blows there. I wrote to my son tonight, a long letter. While writing it, I had again and again a sense of Eric's presence, as if I should see him if I turned. Why do I keep such notes as these? For my son to read, little good they would do him. I write to be writing in my own language, perhaps. Arhahad Susmi. Still no mention of the envoy has been made on the radio. Not a word. I wonder if Genli Ai sees that in Orgain, despite the vast visible apparatus of government, nothing is done visibly. Nothing is said aloud. The machine conceals the machinations. Tybe wants to teach Karhide how to lie. He takes his lessons from Orgain, a good school. But I think we shall have trouble learning how to lie, having for so long practiced the art of going round and round the truth, without ever lying about it or reaching it either. A big Orgota foray yesterday across the A. They burned the granaries of Tekember. Precisely what the Sarf wants and what Tybe wants. But where does it end? Salosa, having turned his Yomesh mysticism onto the envoy's statements, interprets the coming of the Ecumen to Earth as the coming of the reign of Mesha among men, and loses sight of our purpose. We must halt this rivalry with Karhide before the new men come, he says. We must cleanse our spirits for their coming. We must forgo Shif Grethor, forbid all acts of vengeance, and unite together without envy as brothers of one hearth. But how until they come? How to break the circle. Guioni Susmi. Slossa heads a committee that purposes to suppress the obscene plays performed in public kammerhouses here. They must be like the Kahaidish Huhuth. Slossa opposes them because they are trivial, vulgar, and blasphemous. To oppose something is to maintain it. They say here all roads lead to Mishnori. To be sure, if you turn your back on Mishnori and walk away from it, you are still on the Mishnori road. To oppose vulgarity is inevitably to be vulgar. You must go somewhere else. You must have another goal, then you walk a different road. Yege, in the Hall of the 33 today, I unalterably oppose this blockade of grain exports to Karhide and the spirit of competition that motivates it. Right enough. But he will not get off the Mishnori road going that way. He must offer an alternative. Ogarain and Karhide both must stop following the road they're on, in either direction. They must go somewhere else and break the circle. Yege, I think, should be talking of the envoy and of nothing else. To be an atheist is to maintain God, his existence or his non-existence. It amounts to much the same on the plane of proof. Thus proof is a word not often used among the Hanarata, who have chosen not to treat God as a fact, subject either to proof or to belief. And they have broken the circle and go free. To learn which questions are unanswerable and not to answer them, this skill is most needful in times of stress and darkness. Tomenwod Susmi. My unease grows. Still not one word about the envoy has been spoken on the Central Bureau radio. None of the news about him that we used to broadcast from Erenrang was ever released here, and rumors rising out of illegal radio reception over the border and traders' and travelers' stories never seem to have spread far. The SARF has more complete control over communications than I knew or thought possible. The possibility is awesome. In Karhide, King and Kyoreme have a good deal of control over what people do, but very little over what they hear, and none over what they say. Here, the government can check not only act but thought. Surely no men should have such power over others. Chuskis and others take Genli eye about the city openly. I wonder if he sees that this openness hides the fact that he is hidden. No one knows he is here. I ask my fellow workers at the factory. They know nothing and think I'm talking of some crazy Yomesh sectarian. No information, no interest, nothing that might advance I's cause or protect his life. It is a pity he looks so like us. In Erenrang, people often pointed him out on the street, for they knew some truth or talk about him and knew he was there. Here, where his presence is kept secret, his person goes unremarked. They see him, no doubt, much as I first saw him, an unusually tall, husky, and dark youth just entering Kemmer. I studied the physician's reports on him last year. His differences from us are profound. They are not superficial. One must know him to know him alien. Why do they hide him, then? Why does not one of the commensals force the issue and speak of him in a public speech or on the radio? Why is even Opsla silent? Out of fear. My king was afraid of the envoy. These fellows are afraid of one another. I think that I, a foreigner, am the only person Opsla trusts. He has some pleasure in my company as I in his, and several times has waved Shifgrethar and frankly asked my advice. But when I urge him to speak out, to raise public interest as a defense against factional intrigue, he does not hear me. If the entire commensality had their eyes on the envoy, the Sarf would not dare touch him, I say, or you, Upsla. Upsla sighs. Yes, yes, but we can't do it, Estrevan. Radio, printed bulletins, scientific periodicals, they're all in the Sarf's hands. What am I to do, make speeches on a street corner like some fanatic priest? Well, one can talk to people. Set rumors going. I had to do something of the same sort last year in Erinrang. Get people asking questions to which you